welcome to this episode of The Cyber Show. The team visited the NEC in Birmingham, UK to attend the National Cybersecurity Show. It was absolutely chocked full of exciting events, talks, vendors, organisations and companies, and we spoke to only a few of them. We're discussing how to solve the skills crisis and all those challenges that cybersecurity is still facing today.
Okay, hi guys. We're here with Adam from Centrum Security. Do you want to tell us a bit about what you do and, who your customers are and why you're here today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Adam. I'm director at Centrum. I started the company 6-7 years ago with my business partner, Tim. We're both pen testers by background, so we've done a lot of testing across government, across private sector, lots of different industries from technology, finance, healthcare, kind of all of the key kind of verticals with a big stake in cybersecurity in the country. We're here today promoting our services, trying to build new business and kind of connect with our customers and potential customers, predominantly, again, customers across those industry verticals. Technology, SaaS, healthcare, etc.
Brilliant. So what would you say is the kind of biggest security threat out there in current, even today or maybe in the next 2 to 3 years?
That's a really big question.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's a one-line kind of summary of cybersecurity intelligence, really, which I think, you know, that quite leans quite heavily, I think, into phishing various forms of phishing. There's 10 different words for phishing. Targeting employees and businesses and things, that's certainly a huge factor.
Yeah.
It's oftentimes quite an easy way into a customer network or into an organization. Yeah. I think, you know, technical threats and things, quite a big one as well. I think I was reading a stat the other day from 2024 study, I think, that said that something like 80% of organizations surveyed that use SaaS had been compromised through their SaaS applications.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think, you know, application security is huge today as well.
Yeah.
AI security, I think you could argue, has also got a lot of concerns around that. Mm. Privacy, kind of ownership of data, all those sorts of things. I think it's also creating a lot of shadow IT as well for businesses. You know, people are developing and implementing AI in their tooling quite often, where, you know, CISOs and things don't even know that's being implemented.
I mean, I think the biggest, we need pen testing desperately. The need is definitely growing. All of these companies employ a lot of software, protocols, ways to prevent attacks, but we don't know if they work unless we've tested them, obviously. But we're seeing that more and more. I think even if we didn't want a pen test, we've already got adversaries that are doing it for us from a malicious point of view. So where do you guys step in? Do you step in at the beginning when these protocols and networks and systems have been established? Or do you work kind of in the middle of the deployment stage? Where do you guys come in?
All three, I suppose, were kind of effervescent in that context, I guess. Ideally, you step in at the beginning because that's the most cost-effective time to step in whilst things being developed, whilst applications are small. By the time they've been developed for 20 years and they're kind of hung together with blue tack and string, it's it's almost too late, you know, to start kind of unpicking everything and fixing, you know, kind of old applications and infrastructure.
So in your terms of pen testing, do you do automatic pen testing and manual pen testing, or is it just one? Because I've had a little bit of experience with pen testers coming in, and they'll plug in a program that I can already use and then print out a report and go, here's £20,000, please. And they don't even write their own report based off that report. So you do get these sort of pen testers that will say they're pen testers, but they're automatic software users, essentially, that print out an automated report. I'm sure that you don't do that. And what do you do? If you didn't know what pen testing is and you've only uncovered that, what do your team do that's different?
Absolutely. That's a really good question. I think that category of pen testers is probably criminal pen testing, which is an extension of continuous pen testing. I think, it's very important to use automation and tooling. At the end of the day, we're assessing applications, infrastructure systems, which are going to take a long time to try and do anything manually. So automation is very important in the same way it is in a manufacturing pipeline. But on the manufacturing pipeline, you also need human beings who are making sure that, you know, products are coming out correctly, that they're being built to the correct specification. And I think that's where pen testing should model that approach. There should be an advantageous blend of manual and automated pen testing to make sure the automated tools are doing things right.
Yeah.
and also following quite advanced methodologies as well, which I don't think automated core tools are fully capable of following. And I think that's where pen testing in its true form really kind of shines beyond what we used to call vulnerability scanning.
I think it's kind of worst case scenario testing. There are certain situations and environments that human consultants know how to pen test. It's great using tools, but you don't know if there's a certain situation where an attacker is going to use maybe some inside knowledge, and you're always trying to look at containerization. And obviously when you're pen testing, and if the client gives you a certain amount of information, you want to make sure that even those most basic attacks that maybe fail with the auto software or auto pen testing tools can then actually be exploited with some really basic human knowledge, maybe even just where a certain router is on the wall, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so this in a couple of months will be outdated. So the OWASP 2021 framework, the A1 was access controls. So if you've got a web application with five different user roles, what you should do to test the OWASP framework is to test each one of those roles and compare the capability of every single role. And then identify potential weaknesses in those access controls where certain users should be able to do something and shouldn't be able to do something. It's very intuitive to a human, but that's almost impossible to automate. So, you know, even as far back as 2021, which now feels quite a long time ago, I mean, you know,
COVID.
You can't test that with a vulnerability scanner / continuous pen testing platform. You need an intelligent human to do it. That doesn't exist in artificial intelligence worlds. There's no chat prompt which is going to be able to figure that out. So, you know, you need specialists who can support with those kind of requirements to test that.
And that's the problem with AI, isn't it? It's based on previous data. But when we look at pen testing and we look at new attacks arriving on the threat landscape, well, they're new. We haven't seen them before. The software may be new, or it's a zero-day attack. Do you think that we need more people coming in externally into organisations as well? Because there's an over-reliance to rely on internal pen testers. And they may be, we've heard before, where they want to cover their friend who might have done a star role on the system and things like that. I've spoken to a lot of CEOs as well who say, well, you can't touch my stuff. It's going to be non-hackable. And then find that there's a big, great big backdoor that your IT put in. You know, so I think that there's real importance of paying someone to come and do that external pen test, because there are no, you know, sneaky little things that sneak under the radar. We're like, you know, there's cybersecurity police coming in and going, oh dear. Is that something that you think is important as well, that you still have that external company that will come in and make sure that everything is correct and as it was stated in the internal report?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important to get some external validation of that, definitely. You know, I think there also needs to be a bit more awareness in the industry and also the buying community, actually, which focuses on understanding what it is you're buying. There's not very much control of it in our industry. Crest, who we're quite closely affiliated with, actually are about to kind of have a little bit of a look of their kind of buying guide for pen testing, kind of rework that a little bit, and I think we're going to play a bit of a part in looking at that with them to kind of better define what types of pen testing might be applicable for different situations. Because you know, there are situations, don't get me wrong, where continuous pen testing type solutions can have a really positive impact and they can be quite budget friendly and they can work. But there's also a lot of cases where you need to kind of approach it in the more
slower moving environments and things like that.
Or a multi-mixed approach. So something that I looked into a few years ago is that I found USB malware hidden in the storage device in the binary. And these sticks from eBay and Amazon, we're making it into every single production environment. You would find IT managers, cybersecurity managers using them, and I'd be like, whoa, where's that come from? Oh, it's come from eBay. Yeah, I know, I've tested that, and I know what it's got on it. That was tested before, and people missed it. It took manual testing and hours of R&D to find that, and it could have infected most of the systems that we have today. So there is this real need for R&D, really, and researching things that no one's really looked at before. Do you agree that that's something that we need to focus on going forward with red testing?
Yeah, 100%. I think the foundations of pen testing have always really, that is the essence of pen testing, isn't it? Is assessing things manually and looking for things that aren't easily detectable. If it was easily detectable and an automated system could detect it, then software developers and things kind of should be catching that in the development pipeline anyway, especially these days where you've got quite a comprehensive CI/CD, you know, and people are using code scanning, they're using all kinds of automation in the development stack. Pen testing needs to be looking for those harder to detect, harder to find vulnerabilities, and that simply isn't going to be done to the same level by autonomous systems.
Yeah,
it's like peering under the carpet where no one else is looking. You get this weird sense. That's what I got. I was like, hang on, something's not right. That's playing up. I just put a USB stick in. I'm going to find it. I know it's on there. And only really a human's going to be able to do that and have that human intuition. And a trained pen tester, right? Training is absolutely vital when it comes to pen testing. You can't just do a security plus and go, I'm a hacker now. It's not going to work. It comes from that foundational knowledge of networking, and you work your way up through and you learn to code. That's a massive part of that chain. So what advice would you have to our listeners who want to get really into that red team? What steps do they need to take to get into it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think certifications are important for the job application process, but I think that's 25-30% of the of what you need to develop. The majority of what you need to focus on is your development skills, your coding skills. Understand how applications are working, build a Windows domain, build a web application in a couple of different languages, understand how IT is working under the hood, and also develop your hacking skills. Obviously, you know, use systems like Hack the Box, like try Hack Me and these things, and, you know, join your local B-Sides community, and, you know, other communities do exist, and, you know, just keep working on those skills and build your passion for technology and breaking it. And that's probably the best pathway you have into a pen testing career.
So if any of our viewers want to find out how to get in touch with your company or you yourself and want to find out a bit more about your products and how they can help, where can they reach out to? Where's your website?
Yeah, absolutely. Our website's www.centrium.co.uk. And you can also contact us at info@centrium.uk. We're on LinkedIn, we're on Twitter, so reach out.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Build them, and this is one of your products over here.
So this is the industrial range. So this is extended temperature minus 40 to plus 70. Designed to be put in like industrial applications, anywhere that could be outside in a box outside. So it could be very, very hot, it could be very, very cold, whatever. And these things will obviously power any devices plugged into them, so PoE, so they will supply the power. So it's our own operating system that's designed to be secure. So it's a secure operating system. It's built like it's a modular-based operating system. So
similar to kind of BSD, or
I don't know if that. Okay. To be honest,
it's kind of access control based. So it's very much modular, like permission based.
So
it's very segregated.
Out of the factory, everything's designed to be very secure, so everything's locked down, there's nothing turned on by default, you have to turn everything on, it's one of those kind of operating systems. So that, and obviously that's well liked in the defence markets and in security markets, people like that. These things will power cameras, these things will power anything you plug into it, so Wi-Fi, etc. We have a range of firewalls as well, so you know we can do the edge protection, security, MacSec, all that kind of stuff. So all the stuff you'd expect.
So also the front end and back end sort of physical devices, both security based.
Trying to keep devices secure.
Yeah.
So edge security, and then obviously if you've got a exposed network, so external perimeter, then what we would use is the firewall between the external to the internal to block anything coming in, so if anybody breaks into the network. We also have a fiber monitoring platform, so we'll monitor the fibers, and if somebody tries to hack the fiber, we know. And we can let the operators or people know that your fibre is being compromised. Attacking fibre is actually quite easy. What we do is monitor the light levels. If it changes, we'll let you know that it's changed. So that's, again, monitoring the external perimeter, all your fibres, to make sure that nobody's gaining access where
anyone who shouldn't have access
stealing your data. So that's all built in.
Modern wiretapping prevention, basically.
It's easier to hack fiber than it is copper nowadays.
Because
all the copper cables are shielded and things like that. So to actually getting into it, and the speeds that we're using on the copper cables, you have to strip each wire out. And it's a nightmare to tap copper, but to tap fiber, you just need to bend it at the the light comes out of the side.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. So we can obviously see that if the fire gets bent, it will trigger and say, you know, somebody's attacking your fibre, or we can take the link down completely so that that tick just goes offline.
The fibre just happens to incidentally be a very good vibration and movement detection
system. Exactly that. Oil and gas use fibre for vibration testing. Yeah. If somebody walks near a gas pipeline, they want to know about it, and they use fibre to do that because it's very clever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So rather than doing it that way, we monitor the light. So we monitor what's being received, and we log that data within the switch itself. And if it changes by somebody bending the fibre or by something happening, then we can let you know, or we can take the link down.
Not quite down to the quantum level, but enough to know that tampering is happening.
Yeah. And basically, you know, if you take the fibre and move it around, we can get it to trigger on just doing that.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is it's too sensitive.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, if somebody opens a cabinet door, you don't want them to say that we're getting alarms, because if you get too many false positives, you start ignoring the alarms.
That's
what happens. Yeah. So we don't want that. Yeah. So but you can tune the sensitivity as well. So you could say, let's make it this much, or let's make it that much, and then with a bit of testing, you'll know what's going on. And if you can work out and fine tune it, and then you'll be able to know if it's being tapped.
And fantastic.
That's a really interesting addition.
Brilliant. Yeah. So you a UK company, and you manufacture these in the UK, is that right?
No. So we're a Japanese company.
Okay.
So founded in 1987 in Tokyo. So head office is in Tokyo. Manufacturing happens either in China or Singapore. So we have complete non-touch China manufacturing if needed.
Yeah. Yeah.
In defence space and security space, that's quite a valid thing to have.
Yep.
So we can then manufacture in Singapore, and then we're in the UK. We're a sales organisation, to sell those products. So
And if people want to find out more about your company online, where will they look?
AlliedTelesis.com.
How do we spell that?
AlliedTelesis.com.
.com. Thank you so much, Chris.
No
Thanks
problem.
For being on the Cyber Show with us.
Okay, no problem.
So we're a human risk management solution.
Okay.
So cybersecurity awareness training.
Okay.
So one thing that sort of sets us apart, I suppose, is our foundation is all from behavioural psychology, human cognition, and the humans themselves. So our CEO is a doctor of psychology, Dr. Nicholas, and he was working in consultancy organisations, and he was doing all these training sessions, and he found himself that his behaviours weren't actually changing.
Yeah.
So if his behaviours weren't changing, the vast majority of people out there won't be changing.
Yeah.
So he based SoSafe off, like I said, behavioural psychology, etc. So I was trying to change those behaviours. So all of our e-learnings, for example, are nice and bite-sized chunks. There's nothing too laborious or tedious.
Yeah.
Everything is short, snappy, but concise. And then from that, we reinforce that information with our sort of individual phishing simulations, which differ from the people inside the organisation. So you guys, if you're in the cybersecurity team, might get something different to me in the sales team, because our day-to-day lives are going to be very, very different.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of individual learning paths that we sort of look at. So as opposed to just, a one-size-fits-all sort of approach or solution, we try to change it individually to the person so that we can actually change their behaviours and then build that human firewall, which is what we call it.
Human firewall. I like that term. That's a good
exactly.
term. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah.
Layer 8, yeah.
We kind of call that the layer 8 of the OSI model.
Exactly, or the human firewall, as we call it.
And your training is developed in-house. You have a bespoke training, do you, that you figured out yourself?
Yeah, of course. So we have an in-house team. We actually have psychologists involved in that team who, create some of the modules and what's going to attract people. So when people sit down and they partake in our training, they're not necessarily, it's not boring. I know, cybersecurity awareness training might not be the sexiest thing in the world, but we are trying to make it, that just a little bit more human-centric and human-friendly to the person who's actually going to be using it.
Yeah.
Because they're the people that are going to be protecting that organization. So we're trying to turn the individual from the weakest link to the strongest link inside the company.
How long has your company been running?
So I believe we started in around 2018 or 2019 in Germany. So we're a German company, and we've grown exponentially since then. So I believe there's almost 600 individuals now in the organisation. So in that sort of space and time, we've grown, drastically. Mm-hmm. So we are the number one human risk management solution in DACH in Germany, and we are definitely the fastest growing in in the the rest of Europe and in the UKI. And we've just recently, you know, looking at, we recently set sail for Australia and New Zealand and stuff as well. So we're trying to get out there. We're trying to spread the good word, I suppose.
Yeah. I bet you're seeing a huge increase in customers around Europe at the moment as they're looking for kind of European-based security providers.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, with everything going on, you know, I would be very surprised if, you know, Europe doesn't start to grow a little bit further now again.
What do you think are the biggest challenges in behaviour training, Connor?
The biggest challenge, well, I suppose, I think the biggest challenge is potentially, you know, speaking to a few different clients and prospects and stuff is, first of all, trying to get the employees engaged and actually trying to change their behaviours. Because employee engagement would be one of the biggest challenges that, you know, the vast majority of our, you know, the organisations that we work with.
Yeah, do they buy into
exactly.
the project?
Yeah. What's the buy-in like? So that's why, you know, the sort of bite-sized training and the little bit more human-centric side of the training, as opposed to just, you know, long videos, long PowerPoints, laborious tasks, stuff that when people sit down to do, they're not going to want to do ever again. So we're trying to turn away from that to say, okay, that, you know, that last bit of training, first of all, it was actually a little bit enjoyable. I actually learned something, but it helped me and it helped my organization. So when I got a phishing simulation, I say, oh, I remember that. I remember to look at the URL, I remember to look at the sender, I remember to look at the link. So actually being able to reinforce that information with our phishing simulations is something that's really important.
And I think we tend to find usually with training is that there's a huge driven almost forceful training within organisations, and the employees kind of turn to a kind of dismissive, I'm just going to skip through this stuff, it's not important anymore because I can't pay attention to it. And then we tend to find people learn more when they're actually engaged and enjoying themselves at the same time.
So how would you make it fun? Have you given me an example of, like, one of your sessions that that's a laugh or something?
Well, I suppose so. The way we look at it, there might be a 2-minute long video. Now, not all of our trainings are video based because we don't want it to be that you can just sit down, put a video on, and then, you know, that's it, make a coffee. So there may be, you know, a 2-minute video, and then there may be a 2-minute like drag and drop, or, you know, using the information that you would have got in the video and then reaffirming that with, say, a little game or a drag and drop
exercise.
Exactly. And then on the back of that, there might be a 2 or 3 question questionnaire just to really, you know, send home that information. So all of our e-learnings might be, you know, at most 6 minutes, but then that's it. And then you can get on with your day. So you can do that at the start of your Monday morning, you can do that, you know, just after lunchtime on your Tuesday. But it's something that you shouldn't be hiding away from. Or, you know, we're trying to, you know, like I said, put a little bit more entertainment into that.
Fantastic.
Where
will people find your company online, Connor? How will they get
And so it's sosafe.de, as we are still a German organisation. But, you know, we're all over, you know, just look up Human Risk Management or SoSafe onto Google, and then obviously on LinkedIn as well.
I think we've seen you, haven't we? We have seen you. Thanks so much for your time, Connor. Hi, I'm here with Nora from Digital X-Ray. They're a Doncaster UK-based service provider for all kinds of cybersecurity. And Nora, can you tell us a little bit about the company, how long you've been going, and what your kind of main selling points are?
Yeah, sure. So we've been going for 10 years. We are turning 10 this year, so lots of celebrations to be had, hopefully. We actually were founded by two people who worked in cybersecurity and technical roles and had done a lot of consulting with huge telecom companies, but they sort of saw a gap where cyber was limited to large organizations that had huge resource, and they said, you know, just because a company is a bit smaller doesn't mean that they shouldn't be able to protect themselves. So they founded Digital X-Raid to be cybersecurity for everybody. So we are very lucky that we offer the three pillars of cybersecurity. We have offensive services, our sort of flagship security operations center for defensive services, and our compliance team, who are amazing and everybody loves them.
Brilliant. So your tagline is
big enough to deliver, small enough to care.
Yeah.
And we also have don't let the bad guys win.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Okay. I like. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So if you had a tip for everybody, because our kind of tagline is cybersecurity for everyone.
Yeah.
We do civic cybersecurity, so that your gran has as much protection as JP Morgan, you know. And
which is needed, actually. Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you had to give a tip for everybody for cybersecurity today, what would that be?
I guess in terms of businesses that we work with, just find a provider, not necessarily the best or most expensive tool or the biggest provider, find the provider that works for you. So we are more of a boutique agency, and we will sit down with our customers and just find out what their specific requirements are. So find somebody who's not trying to push a service or sell you something to help with their licensing with Microsoft or whatever it might be. Find the people who want to help you and want to keep you secure. And I guess that goes for the public as well. Just, you know, find people that you trust, sources you trust, like the National Cybersecurity Center, National Crime Agency. Take advice from the right people.
Hi, we're here at the National Exhibition Centre, the National Cyber Show. I'm speaking to Ian from the Cybercrime Unit, and we're going to be talking a little bit about civic cybersecurity and the idea, which we've heard a lot today, which is cybersecurity for everyone. The last company we spoke to, their tagline was big enough to defend and small enough to care. And we're very much cybersecurity for everyone. And this idea of civic cybersecurity, that your gran will get as the same kind of security as JP Morgan. And that's what we're hoping for. So, Ian, would you like to tell us a little bit about what your work is and what you do? And
that's interesting. So, a regional organised crime unit is a unit that part of it is cybercrime. So what we try and do is get to all kinds of businesses, also reaching out to individuals really as well. With our local officers, and we're just trying to make them aware of how important cybercrime is, how it happens, what they can do to protect themselves really, or for free, and it's just to make them aware of what we're seeing on a daily basis, and what the dangers are. It does scare them, I will admit, it does scare them. We don't scare them, we haven't done our job properly.
Right, now that is really interesting, because we just had a couple of very interesting conversations about psychology, and I was comparing this to a medical doctor who told me that how she put on lectures and health advice about diabetes, heart disease, cancer, all sorts of things, but people wouldn't come even though they were free, because they sort of didn't want to know. And we've been picking up a lot of this vibe from the sort of civilian cybersecurity side, is that people are a little bit scared to even talk about it. As a challenge, how do you think we can get over that?
Yeah, a lot of people bury their head in the sand, don't want to know, don't make it a priority because they believe they're too small to be hacked or too insignificant, so to speak. So we try and get them attend, and as soon as you get through to them, they realise that they need to do something about it.
Yeah.
And they realise that it's never going to go away. It's going to happen at some point.
Yeah.
The challenge is getting them to realise that. But I think we do a good job of that once they attend and talk to someone.
And how does your outreach work? What mechanisms do you need to use to connect to people?
Mainly word of mouth, believe it or not. At the moment, it's a lot of word of mouth. No matter what you put out on LinkedIn, social media or anything like that, they see it, they can ignore it. But once you get into somewhere and they're recommended by someone else, that's normally how it happens.
Okay.
Good example, we went to a council. We did loads of escape rooms with them, with all sorts of departments. They then recommended them to schools and other councils, and we were just influx of people going, we want to do that. So, yeah, that's mainly how it works, word of mouth.
And how would people get in touch with you and find out about you?
So they can either put in Roku in Google and their local town, That'll put them in touch, or normally their local officers or local police will have a department and then someone that deals with that.
Fantastic. Helen, would you like to continue that conversation on the domestic violence side? And because I think there was loads of places you could take that, yeah?
Okay. So what sort of crimes are you guys looking at? Is it everyday crimes that happen to people, or is it more those company crimes that we're looking at?
A bit of both, isn't it?
Yeah, we... From our side of things, we deal with small businesses, we deal with charities, we deal with individuals, we deal with schools. So any offences that are coming through that are part of the Computer Misuse Act. We have, I think the majority that come through to us are social media hackings, aren't they? Email hackings, that type of thing. That is, we have a weekly dissemination. I know from Warwickshire, I'm based in Warwickshire, that is the majority of the incidents that are fed through to us.
And what's the impact? So a lot of people still think that if you get hacked, you know, it's just a computer thing, you might get some money out of your bank. And actually, it leads to domestic violence and abuse and even murder at times. Can you explain that to people who aren't aware of it?
Yeah, so domestic violence is they'll use their IT to stalk. They can put in air tags, they can hack social media and follow them on there, make fake accounts and follow them on social media to see what they're doing and what's going on. So that is what they're doing a lot. They're looking at iPhones and following them on that as well. They believe that they can't be helped, but we can help them. Domestic violence is becoming more and more in cyber, although it's not entirely enabled, as they call it, in cyber, but it's still there and it's growing. But the knowledge is growing from our side, so we're making more and more people aware. We're working with, believe it or not, Aston University in regards to getting that message across to domestic abuse victims, safeguarders and stuff like that. To make them aware of what's out there and what we can do to prevent it from happening, or the advice to victims.
So where I'm from in Hampshire, when we were speaking to the local police department, they said they have one man for the entire county that can actually understand a hacking offence. Is this something that's quite common outside of the area they're working on, and is that something that you're really trying to focus on? I think there's a talent issue of attracting the right people into these roles, which aren't maybe as glamorous as some of these big tech companies we see around us. Is that something that you're finding a real challenge?
I think we're
quite lucky.
At a force level, we've been established for 3 to 4 years. Prior to that, there was no cyber capacity in any form at a force level. I think the majority of forces are starting with small units, and we are a small unit. At force level, we've got four, I think. West Mercia the same, Staffordshire are similar, yeah. West Midlands slightly larger, and at Rockhue you've got, how many's on your team now?
Protective advice on Rockhue's only two of us.
Yeah.
But we've got intern normally every year that we get an intern in. We have researchers. It sounds small, but at the moment it's manageable, but it's going to... If we can reach out to a lot more people, then we will need more.
Mm-hmm. And in comparison to, like I say, 3 or 4 years ago, we were non-existent.
Yeah.
So from a domestic violence point, it's been in the last 12 months, we've had quite heavy focus on the domestic violence side of things. So like I said to you earlier, we now have a designated input specifically for domestic violence within the cyber arena, because it's that silent area that isn't visible. So if you have a domestic violence victim that's been physically abused, it's visible, whereas the cyber side, it's completely psychological, and the impact of that psychological abuse can sometimes be more long-standing than any physical abuse.
It's absolutely awful when you look at some of the things that they're doing. It really does aim more at women a lot of the time, and about sexualization of those women and children to some extent, are victims more so than anything else. Something that I look into is, you know, like how many viruses or malware do we find in certain software? Mm-hmm. Software aimed at teenage girls is through the roof. It's completely covered in it, and you'll find it everywhere. But if you take a game or a software that's mostly aimed at white middle-aged men, you're not going to find anything in there at all. So there really is this conversation that we need to have, is who is the most likely to be targeted and how do we protect those? Mm-hmm. And I guess having a unit like yourself, you're able to finally put all of those pieces together and create that real policing plan that will help keep us all safe.
Yeah. Our bread and butter is protect, isn't it? It's trying to get in front of those people, whether that be women, whether that be children, whether that be businesses. It's trying to get in front of those people to give them that protect advice to prevent any of that happening, or to reduce the chances of any of that happening in the first place, and to give them the confidence that you don't have to be a tech expert to put those measures in place to protect yourself. We try and use the language that's appropriate for that audience, so that they feel secure in using those skills and using that advice and that ability to help themselves, which eventually helps us, because then if the crime isn't happening, then helps all around.
Do you feel that you need more help from central government, such as the NCSE, who could train the public at a much earlier age, maybe in the school environment, to help prevent that at the end? Because what we're finding is that the cybersecurity in the school area is not very strong at all. We often go and speak to some of those children, and they're totally unaware that they can call the police if they're had. They just don't know what to do.
They're not that.
I got hacked and I don't know what to do. I reset my phone 5 times and I'm only 12. And it's like, okay.
And scared to go and talk to an adult, maybe, and things like that. I mean, the youngest we've got is 6 and 7, is Beaver Scouts.
Yeah.
And they have had cyber education at school.
They do, yeah.
But they're getting that message that if there's something on your phone that's not right, and or you're scared or worried about it, that is still hard to get across.
Where to go to, isn't it? I think a lot of children today do have a lot of knowledge that the older generations don't necessarily have, but it's where to go. It's when to identify that that's wrong, when to identify that that's a crime, and then where to go with that, who to speak to, that maybe the awareness isn't there and that could be promoted.
Yeah.
It's all about, don't do this, don't do that, but we need to talk more about the crime side of it.
Yeah, I tell you, Graham, I mean, they do talk about it in schools, but it's down to the child being confident enough to see a teacher that knows what to do, and so they can teach them and put them in the right way, and that is one of the biggest problems in education. They're afraid to go to an adult, like you said, or to a teacher and say, this has happened. It's very few and far between, because they'd rather stick their head in the sand and deny it's happening because they're too afraid of the repercussions.
Yeah. You should have seen the faces of the year eights when we said to them, if you have had something go wrong to you, don't talk to a trusted adult if that's what you don't want to do. Actually, ring the police instead, because they really do know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You might find that they don't have to go and tell your mum and dad if it's embarrassing, and it means that your friends probably and things might not find out. So if you don't feel comfortable going to a teacher or a parent, you can go to this whole group and we give them that rundown. We give them all of your details so that they can get in touch with you and do that. Because a lot of the time when you're young and it's embarrassing, you want that anonymized. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be talking to your mum and dad about something like that at all.
No, and I think there's a lot of parents as well have a limited amount of knowledge, and sometimes the children know more than the parents. So the children have a resistance to talk to their parents because their parents don't necessarily know what they're talking about anyway. And that's no disrespect to parents. That's just an age gap and lack of knowledge from the parents. But yeah, the children are more than welcome to come and speak to the police at any time. We're not scary. Well, I'm not. Are you?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, well, guys, thanks so much for talking
to
us.
Very welcome.
And what's your top tip for all of our listeners at home to keep themselves safe online?
A good enough password that's not repeated.
Absolutely. Yeah. First time we've heard that, which is shocking. It's the most fundamental, isn't it?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Welcome to the ICO. So what is the ICO? What do you do?
So the ICO is the Information Commissioner's Office. We're the regulator for data protection. So we help businesses get data protection right in their business. And then we also provide advice for individuals as well, protecting their rights when it comes to data protection.
So why have you come to a cybersecurity and security event show today?
So we're really interested in talking to the industry itself, so seeing what how people are using information in innovative ways. We spoke to lots of people at the show. It's been really interesting having those conversations. Also just raising the profile of the ICO and data protection laws, helping people get it right in their businesses. We've had great conversations with people, directing them to all of our resources. We've got loads of tools on the websites helping people get it right and keep information secure.
So if I needed help as an individual or even as a business, where can I go to get that information from the ICO to actually help me keep my data safe?
So I'd say the best place to start is our website. So it's ico.org.uk. We've got different sections for organisations and a different part for individuals. And if you are a small business, we've also got a dedicated page for it, which includes advice for small businesses, which just gives the advice in a bit of a more layman's term, so more broken down. So that's a really great place to start if you're new to data protection. It's going to be a bit more accessible and bite-sized compared to the main pages, which are great. They've got loads of information.
So I think anyone who's worked in cybersecurity in small or medium businesses has had a fight where a breach has happened, or you've had an incident that's quite bad and it's maybe evolving, and you've gone to the high-ups and you've said, I really need to report this to the ICO. It's my ethical responsibility to do so. There can be a lot of pushback and a lot of fear from that. I think that they think, well, we're instantly going to get, you know, a 10% or a 6% fine, and there's a lot of confusion about that. I know for a fact that you're not going to be doing that. If we look at the ICO fines, they're to those big, big companies. They do not hit your small company that's got less than £1 million in the bank. Is that correct?
Yes, I'd say there's a couple of things there. So starting off with whether you need to report in the first place. So not all breaches do need to be reported. It comes down to the level of risk. So that's the first thing. But even if you do have to report it to us, not all businesses get fined. In most circumstances, we'll just provide you with some advice on how to deal with the incident and what to do to prevent a recurrence going forward. And that's in the majority of cases, especially if you are a small business, like you said. It's unlikely that you're going to get a fine. Really, those fines are going to be happening in the most serious types of breaches or the bigger organisations.
So really, you're a really good tool and a really good helping tool for those small and medium businesses if they want to get help or they've had any problems like that. They realistically need to call you to get that assistance and to get that support rather than sort of letting the policeman know that something's gone wrong, because it's not like that at all, is it really?
No, of course, like, we are here to help you in... help you prevent it in the first place, and if you've had it, give us a call. We'll talk you through what to do. We are here to help you, and we know it's a very stressful situation, so if you have looked at our resources on the website and you still need a helping hand, give us a call. We're open 9 to 5. We've got an anonymous helpline and we'll be happy to talk you through the incident.
Amazing. And just out of interest, what's your top security tip? If you had to give one tip to everybody, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good one. I'd say there's a couple of things. I'd say make sure that you've got appropriate controls in your business, things like adequate passwords, and we've got a lot of resources on passwords, and making sure that you're keeping all your systems secure. Multi-factor authentication, use that as much as you can on as many systems as you can. That'll just add that added layer of security, help people prevent getting into systems they shouldn't be able to.
And that's why they do what they do, because they're best at advice. There you go. Thank you so much.
Hi, thanks for talking to us at the Cyber Show. Escapism
learning,
and
yeah.
learning
yeah.
Mixed together, and you're teaching in the cyber area using...
Yeah, so what we've gone for is training through gamification. So trying to make it more engaging to learn rather than just reading the slides.
Yeah.
We want people to actually get hands-on, to be able to practice some of the normal things you would teach, cybersecurity, phishing, encryption, that kind of thing, but do it in a hands-on manner. People have more fun doing it, playing in teams with their colleagues, and they'll retain it much better and be able to apply that in a much better way than just reading it and then getting to the 80% in the quiz and forgetting about it.
Yeah. Now, we really believe in this, and we think this is a fantastic method. Tell us, how much better do you think this is in terms of results and long-term behavioural change? What is it about playing a game that cements knowledge or makes it memorable?
So what we've seen a huge uptick in performance on quite a few different metrics we've done, not even just in cybersecurity, oddly, but in just gamification training in general on different topics. We've done some around data quality as well. And the reason people can remember it better is because they've actually enjoyed doing it. They've enjoyed doing it with a group of their peers, or they've enjoyed having a laugh. So it's amazing the number of people that under pressure can't put together a jigsaw. But that act of a team bonding together over it and having a bit of fun with it means that they will remember that day.
Yeah.
We had an example of a customer where we had taken team photos. We went back to the customer 2 years later and they still had the team photos with the principles of what we taught them on the frame on their desks.
That's an amazing impression, a long-lasting impression.
Absolutely, yeah.
So this is something that you have to be done in person with teams. It's not like online training. So it has different scalability.
Yeah.
But also, I guess it's very much fun for the instructors to go along. What kind of size cohorts do you teach, and what's possible with this method?
With the physical games, we say kind of teams are 4 or 5 people.
Yeah.
Just because the more, if you have too many people, people aren't engaged.
Yes.
You know, there's always going to be somebody that's sat at the back, not really joining in, not taking anything in from it. The games take about an hour-ish to play, depending who's playing.
Yeah.
In terms of the instructor, we actually designed this in a way that you don't need a facilitator as such. The games are all self-managed, which is quite nice. You only need someone to reset it at the end to make that facilitation easier, because obviously that can be a real constraint going into a company. You don't have a dozen people to help do this, and also more expense to do as well. We want to keep the cost down so people can enjoy it as much as they can. We do actually have online versions of these games as well, because we understand that physical isn't always possible, although we would encourage people to do the physical one because it has the biggest impact.
Yeah. Now, a classic kind of cyber challenge is to break into something, whereas escape rooms are always to break out of something. Tell us, how does that work? What type of games and what kind of challenges work the best for education?
It's an interesting one, because we try and adapt the games. Each game, each version of the game covers the latest trends and topics as best we can. Some are more challenging than others, including the games, but we always want to make sure that we're given a story to what's being done. So often our games might be like a chase the hacker style game.
Yeah.
So it'll be who's hacked somebody. You need to find who this person is.
Yeah.
So we use all of the methods that the hacker would use, but now you're using them in a positive way to figure out what's happened.
Yeah.
To then get to the answer. So it's still, you know, you come to a conclusion at the end, and you're rewarded with, yes, you've won. And then often we'll have a prize or some kind of sweets or something like that.
So a bit of a murder mystery whodunit element to it as well, the detective work. That's fantastic. So I take it you're a UK-based company?
Yeah, we are, Where are you from? London. We're based in London,
Okay. Yeah. And if people want to contact you online, if people are interested in using you for training, how would they get a hold of you?
You can go online to our website, escapismlearning.com, or drop us an email at info@escapismlearning.com.
Escapism Learning, all one word?
Yeah, all one word, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on the Cyber Show.
No problem. Thanks for stopping by.